let me catch this up here. Takes me a minute, because I'm slow. Says we're live. I wonder if I get any views on this one. The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Yeah, I got to do something. We're going to be talking about tithing. We're calling it the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Because they're coming after you. Oh, me. I shouldn't say them things. One of these days that I'm big and famous, people to take me out of context, I will be in a mess. Okay. Yeah, I was talking to Tracy last night, and I said, baby, I just don't know how, you know, talk about all this death stuff. I mean, this is kind of King James language, and I said, you know, I don't want to wear everybody out. You know, I'm going through all these parables of grace, and then we ended up with death and least and little and a lostness and, you know, all of those things. So I just, you know, me and Tracy went to the movies yesterday. Oh, don't turn me out for going to the movies. I forget where I'm at. Yeah, Joe's just shaking his head. See, good Christians don't go to the movies. But we did see a good movie. It was called Ordinary Angels. I don't know if you guys have seen that. I picked it out. Tracy wanted to watch Bloodsport. I said, no, baby. I can't be in the Bloodsport movie. So we're going to, you know. You know, she's the one who wants to watch The Walking Dead. It's weird. I'm trying to like, no, baby. The Chosen. But now we actually got done. I came home early. I mean, Lord, I don't know. It's home 5:30 or 6, and it just all evening just, you know, half of it walking through the house. What am I going to? How am I going to explain this? So this is a little bit different. I want to get back into the parables of grace, but I really did call this on Facebook the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse because I want to talk about something. And, you know, it, like Denise said, when you can see these things in real life, well, the thing I despise, I guess, and I'm always trying to, I guess, get it out of the heavenlies, if you so to speak, and realize God has us here now for a reason. If he wanted us out of here, he would have made us out of here. But there is a redoing, a redeeming of the planet, if you will. You know, the garden that he put Adam and Eve in. And we can go through this stuff in so, so, so many ways. The garden was to take over. They were to dress and keep it, and it was to expand. And, you know, I know we can get real King Jamesy and miss out on a whole lot of stuff. And I hope and pray that all of us, when we hear something that maybe is strange to our ears, that we will, like Mary, ponder it in our hearts and not just put it on a, or, you know, throw it away and say he's lost his mind and think about it. Because sometimes maybe what I'm saying is truth, but maybe I don't have the word skills to put it out there. So I kind of fumble along. So I've got to, again, I mean, I'm seeing this mimetic desire, this scapegoat mechanism, and I wanted to wait till we went back into the book of Revelation. But I said last night, I said, well, because I kind of talked about a little bit on our podcast that's coming out next week. I said, well, I've just got to dive in because if I can explain some of the stuff, some of the terms that we use that are common in Christianity, salvation. And salvation, what does salvation mean? Salvation basically means go to heaven when you die, right? I mean, that's common in Christianity. That's a common, when you say anything other than that, you kind of, but really what is it? You know? If it's not that, or maybe that's included, I don't know. But you know, what is he talking about? Do we have pictures of it in the scriptures? So all of these things, you know what? You know, when you're a guy sometimes, you get something. Remember when you was little and you got something, you took it apart to see what makes it tick? Did you ever do that, Teddy? Take it apart? Yes. Why'd you take it apart? I just want to see how it works. And it must have a dent again. Yeah, that's right. But, you know, when you understand, because, look, if you don't know how the world's systems work, then how are you going to know how the kingdom works? Basically, and most people don't even care. The kingdom is just, you know, we talked about this Wednesday. Paul here, when Paul is writing his Roman letter, Paul was not so much concerned about you going to heaven when you die. As a matter of fact, he never makes the statement, go to heaven when you die. Paul's whole concern was how you are living your life now, right? Christianity's the one who kind of came out and said, hey, look, live any way you want, make a deathbed confession, that's good, I got in, I'm good. And you know, guys, you've wasted your whole life. You've wasted it. But Christianity is that, is it not? Just make your confession and do everything in your power to hold on to that. And then we get a bunch of denominations. Once saved, always saved. Lose your salvation. And it's all about a ticket on a gospel train up in the sky. And I'm going to get a go because I'm a railroader. I know how to fix the tracks. And y'all don't. You know, you see, I was telling them on Wednesday, I'll tell you guys, it's not funny, but you begin to see it everywhere. You know, I work for the railroad, and I don't know if you've seen it in the news, there's trying to be a hostile takeover from a company on to take over the railroad, to drive profits up. Everybody's in an uproar. When I say an uproar, do you know what that means? They're scared. Everybody's scared they're going to lose their position, get laid off. You know, it's always that way because we as human beings hate change. And guys, I know where all y'all sit because y'all sat in the same place. Once y'all come in here and nestle down in the chair, you came back the next Sunday, you sat in the same one. I mean, I know when we first came on this side, it's a walk around the building one time, but it's a walk around the sanctuary, whatever you call this place. And you look, because you know when you sit there, Denise, that's it. You're going to be there from now on. And, you know, really a person needs, we need to put names on chairs. Because if you get strangers and they come in and take your seat, it's like, I'm glad they're here, but we need to have a stranger section. We do. And guys, I'm no different. I'm not pointing any fingers. I'm no different. We as human culture, anthropological beings, this is what we do. We hate change. So here comes this company. They're attempting to take over. So we get a letter from the union. And the letter from the union is, oh my gosh, we all got to stand in solidarity and stop this from happening. And the company has created a great work environment and we work together. And it's just the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, we've got this long-standing relationship. I could pull up the letters from a year and a half ago when we was in contract negotiation. The carrier they're about the worst work culture in the whole world. They're not concerned about anybody's safety. They're always out to get us and take our money. But now that we got a common enemy, now we come together. You see what I mean? And when you and you know what? Most people are oblivious to this. Because I'm watching them right now saying, yeah, we like our CEO. Yeah, he's the greatest thing. And, you know, 2 weeks ago, it's like, man, I don't know. We need to get rid of this guy. He's crazy. I just kind of sat back and watched. None of these are my opinions, guys. I'm just sitting back and watching. I'm telling you the facts that are going on. So when you go to the ball games and we look, and guys, there is a connection with shootings at parades. There is a connection here. There's a connection with taking somebody who is victimized and making a hero out of them. You know the guy a couple of years ago, Mr. George, up in Minnesota. And then we look and we say, how horrible is that? I mean, now we've made a hero. They even make pictures of him like Jesus. And, you know, and us as Christians, we think, how crazy. But when you understand how the system works and how humanity thinks, then you can understand it. You can understand why now that we have people taking weapons in schools and shooting people. Never had that before. What's changed? Well, our society's going downhill. Well, when you understand how and what is taking place here, then maybe, you know, like Paul, I wouldn't have you ignorant, people of Satan's devices, of what is actually going on, the terms that are used in our society today that you almost have to stand against. I started to look it up this morning, but I forgot. I was busy doing something else, and I said, I need to look that term woke up. Maybe I will. I guess we got time, ain't we? What, I know the term comes from being awake, right? But what is its slang meaning in our society today? Does anybody know? Woke meaning. Huh? Google. Woke is an adjective derived from African American vernacular English, AAVE, meaning alert to racial prejudice and discrimination. Beginning in the 2010s, it came to encompass the broader awareness of social inequalities such as radical injustice, sexism, denial of LGBT rights. Alert to racial prejudice and discrimination. And when I read this right here, and you think, yeah, them guard dog things. Guys, I'm telling you, the scapegoat. The scapegoat mechanism is alive and well in this very thing. So I wanna talk about it. I may not even use the Bible till the very end, because I do. I want to get to these horses, but man, I want us to see, you know, why that we can take two kids and put them in a room with 100 toys, and within 2 minutes, these kids are fighting over one toy. Why is that? We think, oh, what? I mean, this is mimetic desire. When I say mimetic, mimesis, this is imitation desire. Our whole culture runs on this. Advertisements run on this. Everything. It's not really the product. The product is there, but it's the desire. It's the, you know, I probably won't be able to find it, but I believe it's in Exodus. Maybe I will read a verse. In Exodus chapter 20, I believe this Bible's got Exodus. No, I went from Genesis to Leviticus. Oh, it does have Exodus. Oh, that's good. Listen to this. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his servant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Thou shalt not covet. This is why would God say that? Who come up with the idea that, man, your cave looks better than my cave? I want your cave. Your cave is more rocky than my cave. You know, guys, human beings are an incredible force for good or for evil. Either way. And it's our ability to take the tension that is derived from our inability to desire directly and only want things through imitation. Again, kids fighting over the same toys. And we relieve that tension through this mechanism of the scapegoat. You guys are probably going to be sick and tired of hearing this. Countries fighting over the same resources. You know, we were talking about this. If we really trust that God is a God of abundance, but we don't trust that God is a God of abundance. We don't really trust that God is good. So we live our whole lives through fear. Guys, our government is based on nothing but fear, right? If you don't elect me, man, you're going down. The whole country, the whole world will end if you don't elect me. And I can even create the chaos to keep you in fear so that you'll elect me. It's how we operate. We got to have enemies. We can direct that tension to a scapegoat, to a victim, to an outsider. And then that allows us to come back together as larger social groups and unlock the potential there of that society. And that's really a disturbing ideal if you think about it, because to think that everything that humanity has accomplished, everything that allows us to be our best in terms of our ability to shape the world, comes from our ability to exclude others. I didn't even know I grew up in a religion that was all about exclusion. What do you think Calvinism is? There will be people that will fight you tooth and nail and say, they can't come in our church. God, their name's not written in the book. God's got a big old book in the sky with names in it. You see, but you know what? They really need that. They really need that because that is how they feel secure. So what happens when you take that away? When you begin to understand how the scapegoat works, and then you understand the consequences of it being removed. This is really, guys, our original sin. Cain and Abel. That's how it is in the biblical story. I want you to understand here sometimes, and boy, I'm going to say some things today. I hope you'll ponder them in your heart, but in the biblical story, it's Cain and Abel. In the human story, it's when one society rises up and slays another society. Because there's a lot of poetry in the scriptures. If we try to get scientific with it, it won't work. I mean, we're going to go through some things, not today, but that we can see that is in the language here. And you know, when Paul is writing his epistles, he's writing against the backdrop of the Roman Empire. And guys, I'm going to tell you something. America is nothing but one of the heads revived of the Roman Empire. I just throw that out there. I mean, we got Caesar. We got the whole nine yards. We got peace by the edge of a sword, right? I mean, the great Ronald Reagan says, we garner our peace through military might. That's how we have peace through the world. Peace through strength. And guys, the peace that God offers is not that way. It's a whole nother peace. It's a peace that passes understanding. It's a peace that we can't even comprehend. It's part of the kingdom. The kingdom of heaven is what? Righteousness. This word righteousness, justification, justified, righteousness. Peace and joy. We can't even comprehend them because we only know the relief of joy through the scapegoating. You know what I mean? And tension builds and builds and builds. It's how Satan operates. It's how Satan keeps control over churches, keeps control over societies, keeps control over families. Raising up, you know, a little violence, I'll say it this way, a little violence to keep big violence from happening. That's the whole operation, isn't it? We'll do a little violence to keep a lot of violence from happening. Our original sin, the murder of our brother. So we all owe this debt to original sin. Not somehow because sin is passed down to us in a genetic way. You know, I go back and guys, I've got all those books, Augustine and Irenaeus and all of these guys, and I've read them, and when you go back and with this is all you know, and now I look and I say, guys, y'all missed it. And I know you're thinking, wait a minute, these are early church fathers. Well, guys, they were just folks. And they were trying to understand the sacrifice of God in Christ Jesus. And they read these things as God needing to be appeased through a sacrifice. God himself needing blood. So we read it, and that's kind of in the Christian community. It's so much in the Christian community that we don't even realize it's there. That we've got blood on the doors. Blood over the doorposts, and we get in everything as blood, 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 blood. But and the Hebrew writer says, guys, there's no more sacrifice. I mean, my gosh, in the Hebrew writer, he says, if the blood of bulls and goats could have ever did that. I mean, and I know when we look at this, we think of sin. Okay, now I got to get my sin atoned for. But if we could just change a couple of words here, maybe in our language, because sin to us is, sin is, oh gosh, I smoked a cigarette. Sin is, oh, I thought a bad word. Sin is, you know, went to a bar. Sin is, you know, all of, so it's actions, it's all of these other things. But if you could really get it in your mind that sin, the original sin is our scapegoating our brother. As Denise said, and how do we do it nowadays? We blame everybody else. It's everybody else's fault. We may not kill them, but it's their fault. Guys, and I've played right in it. You know, they went to the ball games and stuff like Tracy can tell you. I'm sitting right there. And you know why we lost, Tim? The referees. Never mind we lost by 47. It was the ref's fault. You know? So everybody's got to have. And, you know, I watched the game last night. I just seen a highlight. And some guy hit a half-court buzzer. And the refs is running off the floor. You can't blame him because you know they're coming at him. The team loses, it's the coach's fault. The crowd didn't make enough noise. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I mean, we can never say congratulations, you were better. You worked harder, you deserve it. Congratulations. Let's share in your victory. We can't do that. No, I'm coming back and I'm going to get you next year. What we call peace or our ability to live together comes from our ability to push people away. And all of us are born into a society that we imitate. We imitate a society that creates conflict by imitating desire and relieves that conflict by choosing an outsider and a scapegoat to push away. I mean, depends on what side you're on. Because all the problems in the United States, it's either Joe Biden's fault or Donald Trump's fault, right? One of them is going to be a victim in one way or another. Either way you go. I mean, that's the way our whole political system is set up. If you're for them, good, it's the other guy's fault. If you're against them, it's their fault. I mean, it just depends on where you're at. And I can tell you what, guys, the whole system is crumbling, whether you recognize it or not. It's crumbling down around us. So then what? And I want to tell you something. Because of this, I'm going to tell you where religion comes from. Because of this creating conflict through this desire and ability to scapegoat or pushing this outsider out, well, we can't just constantly murder people. We can't just constantly have sacrificial victims. So eventually these ideas need to be ritualized, hence religion. And I can tell you what, guys, Christianity is not a religion. It has no place for this. This is what Paul, but you see, coming out of Judaism was filled with blood everywhere. Blood to the horse's bridle. Blood, 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 blood. But now we come over here and there's no more. Wow. But you see, what is our, now listen, guys, I'm not against all ritual. I'm not. We do this all the time. I believe in baptism. And you know, some people are against. Ritual is a part of our human genome, our human DNA, ritual. God put it in there. It's why you guys sit in the same seats all the time. That's part of ritual. But when we understand ritual, and really when you understand it, it's really a great thing. God gave it to us, but not at the expense of somebody else. See, religion is the way in which we take the generative scapegoat mechanism, this mechanism that allows us to identify an outsider and victimize and ostracize that person. Because of that, alleviate the tension and feel good about ourselves. That's what religion does. The Pharisee would say it this way, right? I thank God I'm not like other men, right? I pray, I do all of this, you know. I look the part, I got all of this stuff. So it's the Pharisee. And you know what, guys? We've all played the Pharisee role. We all have. We don't know that we have, but, you know, some of us think, well, maybe my Pharisaical role is not as bad as other people's. Again, we're going back to the scapegoat. You know, Paul draws that line and says, guys, all guilty. Enough. Quit making excuses. Well, I'm not as bad as that guy. Just stop it. He said, you Jews have hated the Gentiles. And the Gentile says, yeah, that's right. We're sick of it. And then Paul looks at the Gentiles and says, you guys is hating the barbarians. Y'all are all the same. Y'all all had somebody to hate. Stop it. So here again, Rene Girard. He begins looking at all kinds of religious systems. Again, at this time when he began this study, he is not even a Christian. He's beginning to see something. And I think it's so awesome. Maybe in the face of all of our religious mindsets that God shows a guy who's an atheist how this whole mechanism works and bypasses all the theologians of the day and shows him how all of this works. And he wasn't even looking for it. That's the grace of God. So he looks at all of these systems, all of these religions across human history, and he sees the same pattern in every single society, every single culture there is, whether it's human sacrifice, animal sacrifice, sacrificial systems, or whether it's very strict rule-keeping. And when you don't keep the rules, what happens? Out the door you go. So it's this excommunication for those who don't follow the rule. And every religious system follows a pattern of creating scapegoats for the community to push to the outside in order to create the peace and maintain the peace and allow this social cohesion to happen within the group. And all of our social networks, all of them, are built on the backs of pushing people aside. You know, there's a verse in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12, you know, the old beat your kids, you know, the chastening of the Lord. That is such a horrible, 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 did I say it enough, Daddy? Horrible translation of the word. Chastening is the word paideia. It means culture. But we interpret it as beating. Scourging, that word was added. But you know what he says there? He says that we might strengthen feeble knees. Instead of pushing them to the curb, that we might strengthen them. Because all along we have looked for the weak and looked for the victims to push them aside. But now we are to strengthen them that have been victimized and marginalized and ostracized and all of those things. And strengthen them. This sounds like wokeism, doesn't it? Just let me go on with this and you'll see. All of our social cohesion is built on the fact that we are an insider. We're the called. We're the chosen. That makes you not the called, not the chosen. All religious systems are ways to maintain this and systematize this and minimize the damage of it, but nonetheless allow it to continue to work. You see what I mean? So God moved us away from human sacrifice. Abraham, Isaac, right? He moved him away from human sacrifice and gave them animal sacrifice. You can see that. And this is a way in which religion is continuing the violence, systematizing the violence, ritualizing the violence, but also ensuring that the violence is able to do its job and keep the community together. You see, that's its whole job, social cohesion. You guys have witnessed it in churches. You witness it in society. What happens when the church begins to grow? What happens? You guys know the result, don't you? There's a split coming. And everyone, it gets bigger this way. It's going to happen down there. It's going to happen up here. It's going to happen. Guys, it's the writing is on the wall. It's going to happen. Because the only way we can maintain the cohesion is to, but listen, we don't see it because we think, but yeah, really, they're the problem. If we get rid of them, and you know when the them leaves, they take all of them, that is the them with them, and we got a church split. Because we don't know how to function any other way. So now we get denominations and we get companies do the same thing. They split. They go, I mean, and if you ever think about it, it's why sports teams can't stay on top very long. Because you've reached the pinnacle. Now what? What are you gonna do? You're the Super Bowl champions. Now what? Repeat. Now what? Repeat. You see what I mean? So it in that whole system, it kind of taps out. And so it's bound by the very rules of that system. I hope you think about these things. So God gives them a literal scapegoat in Leviticus that they can lay their sins and this goat carries all of their sins and problems and violence, and they release it, they lead it away from the community. And this is a way of systematizing the idea that somebody has to pay the price. All of our sins, all of our mistakes, all of our tension has to be released somewhere on something. This is what religion does. It finds a way to contain our violence, but also use our violence to continue the system. I challenge each and every one of you to go out this week and start looking. Start looking in TV shows, start looking on the news, look on Facebook. And I pray God will show you the scapegoat mechanism is the only system you will see all around you. You'll see it everywhere. everywhere. And you know what, guys? We don't even know how to function outside of it. This is why Jesus would say, my kingdom's not of this world. You guys don't have a clue. But, you know, we thought, oh, God, I feel good. We shouted praise to God. That's the kingdom come. We ain't got a clue. And you know what? The sooner we can come to realize that, then maybe God will begin showing us that. So, I know I gotta hurry. I ain't even got to the horseman. But inside of this, guys, we have in Christianity a story that plays into the mechanism and at the same time undermines it. You know, I've told you, I've went over it before. We did this at the beginning of the year with the scapegoat. I beheld Satan fall from heaven. And in that, this is how Satan operates. Satan cast out Satan. But Jesus didn't say that was foolish. He said that's the whole operation here. But there's got to be a stronger man come into his house and bind him and spoil his goods. And when you understand that, if you can remember last week, I think when we talked about how that when the man's house was swept and garnished and seven other spirits came in and the man's last state was worse than the first, if you guys could hear some of these things maybe and begin to understand the very terms of like that John would use called Antichrist. You say Antichrist, people are scared. Oh my God, I saw a guy today. I think he was Antichrist. He had a tattoo, and you know. We're talking a whole system here because now we've taken this ritualized religion and now this thing has become against, in place of the real Jesus. So in the Christ story, we have a story that undermines the entire premise of the scapegoat. In the Christ story, you have a narrative that is identifying not with a mob who needs the scapegoat, but with the victim. All through the story. You remember when I read you the definition of wokeism? Wokeism was what? When they started to realize about victims. Really? It's a term for us that seems to be a term of hate and disgust and they're woke. But now, listen, guys, you can't be on The Voice unless you're a victim. Have you guys watched The Voice? You guys ever watched The Voice? Everybody that's on there. Had, you know, unless you've had cancer 17 times and your parents is killed, you can't be on there. Because how do they start it? With a sad story. You got to be a victim. And I mean, and this is how the whole thing goes, the pendulum. We as human beings go one way or the other. So now it's all about victims. So what is our society based on now? Our society is based on who can be the best victim. And what is happening in our churches? Who can be the best victim? Who can waller and all and do all this? Who can be the best victim? You see what I mean? So we go from one end all the way to the other. So Christianity, real Christianity, is not really reinforcing the beauty, because God gave it, and the importance and the significance of the scapegoat, because God gave it to him. It's actually building toward the point where God would release us from our need for an outsider, because there comes a point when the scapegoat doesn't work anymore. I went back and, you know, I was looking at the what we call the tribulation and, you know, 70 AD, and why, you know, I got to go back and ask the question, why did Rome attack Jerusalem? They just wake up one morning and think, hey, we need somebody to kill. Let's go attack Jerusalem. Does anybody know? Here's the dumber question. Does anybody care? When you see how these things begin to work, yeah, I'm going to tell you something. I hope I don't get my video taken down. But y'all know that Tucker, I won't say the whole name, went over and interviewed you know, the Russian guy. You got to be careful with your names. Well, you know now who was enemy number one? Tucker. Right. So I'm looking, I'm flipping through something. Oh, I think it was on the news, that news that starts with an F. And it had a picture of all of these guys' faces. And in the caption was, these are all the people that the Russian president has gotten rid of. You know, because now we got to reinforce the idea that he's the enemy. Because if we don't, then we're going to lose our funding to keep the war going. So we got to, and you know what? Most people, oh yeah, never mind. What if they put a picture of H.C., you remember the former first lady and governor of Arkansas? What if we put a picture of her and all of the people that have... But that's okay. I mean, you know, we won't talk about that. We got to have an enemy. We got to have it. But see, then Jesus comes on the scene, and you know what? He tells us there's no more outsider. And when I say there's no more outsider, guys, listen, you know, the outsider in those days would have been a woman with the issue of blood. My God, nobody can. You know, you can't touch her. An outsider would have been a leper. You know, these people that are outside of the community, and Jesus is touching them and involving himself with them, and he's going to their houses and having dinner, and he's telling us there's no more outsider. And, you know, they wanted to wear him out because he says, man, there's no more outsider. And you know what? We as a church, when we declare there's no more outsider, you know what that means? Empty seats. Because we got to have an outsider. We got to have some people that ain't welcome. So all of the violence, all the hatred is turned and now focused on Christ. And let me tell you something. It's not that Christ is a good sacrifice or a better sacrifice or a perfect sacrifice that finally appeases God. I used to think of the perfect sacrifice. He's the one that finally makes God happy. No. It's the fact that Christianity is God playing into our perceived need for a sacrifice specifically so that he can undermine it and free us from it. Free us from it. You notice I'm using this word. You'll know the truth. The truth will make you free. And you know, we say, oh yeah, truth will make you free. Do you ever say from what? So salvation is saved from, I mean, you can include that word, salvation. I mean, if I'm in the lake and I'm swimming in the lake and the lake is 200 foot deep and I get saved, you could already add saved from what? Drowning. I was about to drown. But in Christianity, they don't even say the word, oh, I'm saved. That means I'm going to heaven. No, you got to have a from in there or there's no salvation. Israel was saved from the bondage of Egypt. We are saved from that same bondage, from this scapegoat and this worship of all of this whole system, this bondage of Egypt. This bondage of Egypt that is full of all kinds of gods, and every one of their gods needs a sacrifice. I mean, that's what they did with the Hebrew children, wasn't it? Oh, there's too many of them. They'll rise up against us. Throw them in the river. Drown them. Every human being is naturally socialized into a world that needs scapegoats and outsiders. It's bred into us from the moment we began to see the world around us. Guys, our kids, our little children, I know we get this wrong, and we think, and I know I've said it, but I'm going to tell you what, guys, it's wrong. We think sin is a genetic thing. It's not a genetic thing here. It's not passed down through the genes. Our kids learn this by watching us. We got to get real with it. We think, oh my God, I wouldn't teach my kids. Guys, we mess it up 10 ways from Sunday. They learn how to fuss and fight from who? Us. Oh, and if you're one of the perfect parents, then maybe they learned it from TV. But they learned it all. They learned it all from being with other kids and teachers and going to ball games, which you would think is perfectly innocent, and all of that. And this is how we relieve the tension. This is how we get along in society. So we're all bound in the system. We all owe a debt to this scapegoating, this violence. But Christ comes from outside of the story. He's the God-man who steps into the story and has absolutely no debt to scapegoating, no debt to violence, no debt to evil, no debt to anything but a pure desire to imitate the Father. Guys, this is what he's talking about. I come to do thy will. That will there is desire. I come to do thy will. Our will is our own will, because it comes from our selfish. You know, when you talk about that we might know his will, his desire. Jesus doesn't need to triangulate this desire. Jesus actually desires what his Father shows him and nothing else. Remember, thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's donkey, your neighbor's vineyard, your neighbor's teapot, your neighbor's car. You know, all of the things that so Jesus, with no debt to violence, no debt to scapegoating, he doesn't need to push anybody away. So he can go to the leper. He can go to the woman with the issue of blood. He can go in and do you realize? I mean, you read the story about Jairus' daughter. But let me tell you something, guys. You don't touch the dead. You're a good Jew, doesn't touch the dead. And he goes right in and he lays hands on a little old dead girl. You don't do that, Teddy. And he goes home and puts his hands on the casket of the woman, the widow woman, and then you don't do that. She's the outcast. She's the woman from Nain. Her son is dead. Something has happened. God must be against this woman. He's took her son. God is scapegoating her. So now this is what we do. And we look and we pat our foot and we think, oh, look what has happened to that person over there. God must be against them. And we pat our foot and say, well, look at all the tragedy in their life. We can't be around them. God is somehow punishing them, scapegoating them. So we join in. Jesus doesn't do that. And because Jesus is telling us there's no outsider. And because of that, specifically because Jesus threatens everything that maintains our peace, everything that maintains our social order, and somehow we become, unconsciously, we become threatened by him. It's why he said, they know not what they do. They didn't. And you know what, guys? We're so blinded by Phariseeism that we don't even know we're blind. And the more we do that, the more blind we become. This is not God blinding us. This is us refusing to see. Because now, guys, we're without excuse. In the Old Testament, they had an excuse, I guess, if you will, because they had sacrifice, so the whole system was built on it. But when Jesus came, remember, they were kept under the law. They were kept subject to the bondage of this law, kept subject to the vanity of their own minds until somebody come and took the sacrifice away. Are y'all, as the guy said, are y'all tracking with me? Y'all checking? Am I boring you to death? So we direct, because look, our whole social society is built on this. We got classes like, you know what, I guess most of us would be middle class, somewhere in the middle class, lower middle class, middle class, whatever, but we got classes, right? How many classes do you think there are in the kingdom? I'm just curious. I mean, come on. We got to have some high class, some middle class, some low class, right? I mean, we're doing the church. We got the laity, and then we got the priesthood. Everybody that wears a vest is part of the priesthood. I guess that's me. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you understand here? Our whole social system is based on this. And you know what? Try as hard as you will to get out of that system and the gravity of it, the weight of it. You was doing taxes and you know you had a good year, but what's going to happen when you had a good year? Oh, Uncle Sam going to come knocking at you. You just thought you was having a good year. Let me bring you back down to reality. And you know, I mean, if people would wake up, I mean, really, all of us together and say, look, this system isn't working because I go to work and every dime I make is taxed. And I go over here to the store and everything I buy is taxed. And I buy a car and even though I pay it off, it's taxed. And every year they send me a bill and tax me on it again. I mean, my money's taxed 4 or 5 times. It just taxing, taxing, taxing to feed the system. But you know what? Oh, you know what? We don't want to have too much gravity holding you back. But we got the string tied around your leg. You know, like the dog. You know, he can run, but when he gets to the end of it, he's gonna be jerked back. I used to have a dog do that all the time. He'd run as fast as he'd go. That chain would get him back, and we'd laugh, how stupid. And we do the same thing. Been doing it for 57 years. Thinking we broke free. And when Jesus comes on the scene and says, the truth will make you free. Oh, well, one of these days we'll know the truth. And the truth will be free in heaven. And he said, right now. Right now. But we don't believe it because we're bound in this system. So we scapegoat Jesus. When we scapegoat Jesus, when we direct all of that violence towards God and we're allowed to enact all of our worst and most violent fantasies on Jesus, we crucify him, we scapegoat him. And in that whole situation, guys, there was no people groups that wasn't guilty. We can't say the Jews did it. We can't say it was all the Gentiles. Everybody is involved in it. They all abandoned his disciples abandoned him. Everybody, they abandoned him. But again, the narrative doesn't identify with the mob. It identifies with Christ. It identifies with Jesus in the midst of that. And because of that, Christianity is doing something fundamentally new in the history of the human story. It's telling us that we no longer need to do that. That we no longer need a scapegoat. This is what Christianity does. It goes right to the heart of this scapegoat mechanism and unveils the fatal flaw in it. Because listen, guys, scapegoating only works. I'm going to tell you a great word here. Scapegoating only works if you believe it. You know, if you really believe it's their fault. Have you ever went back and you know, that's the thing that we don't want to do. We don't want to go, you know, look in the mirror, do we? And say, oh, you know what, maybe the reason I failed that test, I mean, I'm going back to teenager years. Maybe the reason I failed that test is because I didn't even open the book. I didn't even study. I didn't come in when the teacher gave the pop quiz. And I said, wait a minute, it's illegal for you to give a pop quiz. It says in the King James Bible, thou shalt not give a pop quiz. Because you told me to read the first 2 chapters, but I was too busy watching Gilligan's Island last night and didn't read the first 2 chapters. And then we was playing and doing all this other stuff. So and it's teacher's fault I flunked. Scapegoating only works if you believe it. You have to actually believe that that other person is the problem. I mean, do you know how many times people are always praying for everybody else? Oh, Lord. God fix them. God fix them. I've prayed those prayers. Ain't you? Y'all liars. Everybody's prayed that prayer. God fix them. Man, really we ought to just be honest and say, God, make them like me. God, just make them like me. Because then they would do what I want them to do. But they don't ever do what I want them to do. So God, please help them open their eyes. See, if you know they're not your enemy, not the problem, that you're just scapegoating them to make yourself feel better, then the whole thing falls apart. It only works when you believe they're the problem. And when Christ comes and tells us that there's no more outsider and we're able to direct all of our hatred and violence toward him, but in that climactic moment, Jesus does not return hatred or violence to us, does he? Jesus says on the cross, I forgive you. You don't even know what you're doing. And it's like our eyes are open in that moment when you see that not only do we see what we've really done, but we have no recourse to defend it. See, that's a double whammy here. You're without excuse. You don't got no more excuse. You did it. Huh? I mean, when you see that, you see, religion just keeps playing on the violence over and over. It's why religion keeps people blinded. Because they say, look, we're the steward of God's church. We got to keep it clean. So we got to kick them people out. They don't look like us. They don't smell like us. They don't talk like us. We got to kick them out to keep the peace. And it just blinds us more and more and more. Because in any other victim, any other scapegoat, any other person, we can always find reasons to justify ourselves. They did this, they did that, they said this. You know, we want to justify ourselves, justify our reason for our violence. But with Christ, there's nothing. They can find no fault. He's done nothing through any of his teaching, nothing to justify what we did to him. And it's in that moment when you see this, really, for what it is, it's like the scales fall off. You know, I mean, go back and look. This is what he says to Paul on the road to Damascus. I mean, I know the King James, but he's saying, Saul, Saul, why are you still doing violence to me? Why are you persecuting me? What do you mean? And what happens? Eventually the scales fall off of Paul's eyes. The violence. And what was Paul doing? Yeah, Paul was doing violence. Why was Paul doing violence? The Christians were the scapegoats because they were, you know, against the system, and we gotta kick them out. And in that moment, you see the world for what it really is, that we've been doing this all along, and our view of the world has been pushing someone aside. So Christ now saves us from that need. Uh-oh. I just almost gave you a definition of salvation, didn't I? Christ saves us from that need, from the need for sacrifice, from the need for violence. Saves us from the need to justify ourselves by putting somebody else down. Wow. That definition of salvation won't go very far, will it? That doesn't sound like go to heaven when you die, does it? Saves us from the need for violence. Saves us from the need to justify ourselves by putting someone else down. This is what the salvation of Christ is. It's the salvation from the sin of scapegoating and sacrificing. All of our violence, all of our hatred, all of our worst tendencies as seen in the world is a function of the fact that we believe we need to know who is wrong because I'm right. Who's on the outside because I'm on the inside in order to know that we are loved and accepted. Christ takes all of that away from us. And when we see the story of the cross and we see Jesus as a fully innocent person who was victimized by us. Now listen, guys, the reason, let me go the other way. You see, maybe you're getting it, what I'm saying. But here's where we go on the flip side. So now, this is how we keep the scapegoat mechanism going. Because now God needs a scapegoat. Now God needs a sacrifice. Now you see what I mean? So I can look at it from my point and say, I need no more sacrifice, but God needs it. So we can just keep the cycle going over and over and over. And as long as God needs a sacrifice, you see what I mean? As long as God needed to be appeased with the blood of Jesus, and you know, this was not God pretending that Jesus was you. When you see the scapegoat mechanism, it is, I mean, you know, when I say all died in Christ and all of these kind of things, we look at it and we say, oh my God, you know, well, we were dead in our lives here with Christ when Jesus died on the cross. I said these things from right here that God was pretending that we were all in Jesus. And he killed us all. This is all scapegoat. This is blindness of the scapegoat mechanism. I've said those things, and guys, I was wrong. I hate being wrong. I despise it. But that's what religion does, guys. It just keeps you in this mindset. So when I'm talking dead, when Paul is talking dead, he's talking dead to sin. Remember in Romans how that we are alive unto God, we're dead to sin? We're dead to that whole system. We've been released from that whole system, made free, saved from that whole system of violence. Needing scapegoats, needing to victims, needing to ostracize people, needing to push people out, needing to put people down to make ourselves feel better. So now you remember, and here's one of the big things in school, isn't it? And here's part of the wokeism. We're going to school now, but in our day, there's no boy in here that's never dealt with a bully. It's part of our society. But so now, what are we doing? We see the victims in the school. So what happens? The scapegoat mechanism isn't working anymore. So now, mad mommies are going to the school saying, that bully stuff, it's over. No more. Now, are they wrong or are they right? They're right. It shouldn't be happening in the first place. But we're going to call them mad mommies because we say, hey, we dealt with it when we went to school. Listen, as a guy, you was either a bully or you got bullied. Am I right, Teddy? You fell in that category, one or the other. And this is all the same kind of system. So now when a mad mommy goes down there and says, enough, my kid is not being the victim anymore, we say they're woke. You see, because we want to do the same thing and put people in categories and all this other stuff. But you see what's happening is the scapegoat mechanism isn't working anymore to relieve the tension. There's no more sacrifice. Listen, let me just jump right over because I'll keep you guys all day and I know you might get bored. But let's, guys, in the book of Revelation, in the book of Revelation, there's a picture here of this. And, you know, Revelation here, it's the uncovering. It's the pulling back. The book of Revelation is very difficult to read. Now, one thing we need to understand as modern audiences is that Revelation is playing with a particular language game. It's using imagery that was convenient for the political, social conversation at that time. And because we don't have access to that imagery, because we don't speak that way, sometimes we can misread it. I give you a newspaper. And you open that newspaper, the newspaper says, the bears wipe out the eagles. What are you going to think? Cowboys destroy the Redskins. You're going to think. I mean, but see, you're just going to know, hey, he's probably talking about a football game. I don't even need to read the newspaper any farther. I'm thinking Chicago Bears, Philadelphia. I'm thinking the Dallas Cowboys, Washington Redskins, because that's the way we think. But 2,000 years from now, you read the headline, and Cowboys wipe out the Indians, and you're thinking, oh, That's why there's no Indians. The dadgone cowboys killed them all. That's why we don't see eagles. The bears got them. I don't know how the bears caught them in flight. Maybe the bears could fly and they could catch the eagles. And we kind of laugh about it. Or maybe I'll show you a cartoon that shows you a donkey and an elephant boxing. What would you think? It's a political cartoon. Okay? So they had that imagery. We don't know that imagery, so now we're thinking Apache helicopters and dragons and all this other kind of stuff. The backdrop was Rome, right? They had that language, and there's a lot happening. And for us to simply read without doing our homework, we're absolutely going to misread the images. So we got the writers of the apocalypse. Many scary images, many misinterpreted thinking here. Many think the writers of the apocalypse is that God unleashing his violence and anger into the world, right? The writers are coming. You know, I can just hear the writers are coming, boy. Because I've heard people say that. All, you know, boy, that's horse number one. It's wrong, boy. Come on, I know, here's the reason for number three. I want to argue something here. I want you to think about something here. Because I want to argue that these writers represent an interim period. When I say an interim period, when between two periods, a period when the sacrifice doesn't work anymore, into this other period of the kingdom of God. There's this period in the middle. Now this first writer, and I'm just skimming along here. I'll be down here in, 10 minutes, hopefully. This first writer, he's coming on the scene and he's riding a white horse and he's got a bow in his hand. Guys, real quickly, Rome didn't fight with bows. Rome fought with sheer scale and volume of people. They would line up, 20,000 soldiers shoulder to shoulder with swords and spears, and they would just march, shaking the ground, conquering everything. So what happened was the Parthians and some of the others realized the same way that the United States fought the British in World War II, in the Revolutionary War, was guerrilla warfare. We don't have the means to fight the might of the Roman Empire. So the bowmen would get on the horse. They would ride real fast. There would be 10 of them. They would run by, shoot, 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 and ride off into the distance. The first writer here in this is about the vanity, the impotence of military might. Militaries can be extremely powerful. Our goal here in the United States is to have the most powerful military in the whole world. But they can never fully contain the violence. They're always vulnerable to attack. If your peace comes through your military, you're always going to be vulnerable to another military. Hence the arms race. Right? These writers are not here to show God attacking humanity. Instead, it's the book of Revelation. It's the uncovering. God is showing the weakness of the peace that we think that we bought through all the taxes we paid, through all the helicopters and missiles and mites and boats and everything that we've got. And we think we're peace. And God is saying no. You don't have peace. And look around. I mean, you guys got young children. Are your young children safe? Do you just feel like, oh, this mighty military we got when my kids go to school, they're safe? Do you feel that way? Absolutely not. The second rider, he's on a red horse. And again, he's not enacting violence. This rider on the red horse, it says he comes and he takes away the peace. If our peace is based on the scapegoat mechanism, based on military might, and we're forced to go along with the systems of the world, we're forced to go along with the systems of Rome, the systems we have in place at the point of death. You either obey the rules or... Then taking that peace away, those systems away, our peace shows itself for what it really is, vanity, illusion. So when he takes away that piece of the scapegoat mechanism, well, that piece doesn't work anymore. Now what are you going to do? And then you get this third horse, this black horse, and he comes with a set of scales in his hands. I'm just highlighting here. You guys can probably know it better than me, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. This black horse, he comes in with scales in his hands, and we see a measure of wheat for a penny and three measures of barley and hurt not the oil and the wine. We see that things that, the oil and wine, we can look at these things spiritual, but it's economical. I want you to just understand this. This is economical. It's not a rider that directs violence on us, but he shows our vulnerability if our systems are taken away. If our peace that's dependent on violence no longer works, then our economics that bring peace, that's based on those who are higher up the food chain, if our economics is based on having certain classes, you know what? There's certain cars you ain't ever going to own. There's certain clothes you ain't ever going to wear because you can't afford them. They're for other folks, right? And our whole economic system is based on that, guys. That's Denise is doing her taxes. And you'll see when you get into the middle class, we pay all the taxes. The rich ain't paying them and the poor ain't paying them. Who's paying them? We are. So our whole safety, our whole economic system is based on that. Well, what happens when you take that away? Chaos. And then you get the fourth rider coming in on this pale horse, the green horse, and it talks about disease and sickness and animal attacks. I'll never pronounce this guy's name, but he was a Greek, Epictetus. I don't know if anybody knows that name. Epictetus. But he says, Caesar has provided profound peace. There's no wants, no battles. You can go wherever you want. And if you look at it, here we are in the United States, we could say our government has provided peace. If you want to go to Exit 7 and shop, you can. If you want to go to the Pinnacle, you can. If you want to go to the mall, you can, right? Go to the movies, you got peace because our government has provided the peace. But at the same time, he says, but can he provide us peace from fever, from earthquake, from storm, from pestilence, from fire, peace from love, peace from envy? So he says, Rome's peace is a false peace. It only appears peaceful because Rome can force us to live by those rules. They make us get along by the edge of the sword. But if that sword is taken away, we would then become aware of the different ways that we are subject to a world that can be very hostile. This is Romans chapter 8. And the whole system depends on you not noticing those things. That's why Paul would say, awake, awake, awake. If you start to see the cracks, the peace that Rome offers is no peace at all. Then you'll begin to question the whole system. Then it all begins to fall apart. And what the writers are doing here, they're not God sending the apocalypse on humanity. They are images of humanity beginning to recognize the cracks in the system. Remember, the revelation comes after the sacrifice. After the fact that we began to see sacrifice for what it really is, and now we begin through the riders to see all of the ways that all of our systems, all of the scapegoat mechanisms began to crack. Our systems crumbled, and we began to cry out. And you can go back and you can read it, that he began to cry out, rocks fall on us, mountains hide us. Hide us from what? From the wrath of the Lamb. Because this is our view. Because, you know, when John is over in Revelation chapter 5 and he sees a scroll in the right hand of him that sat on the throne, and the scroll is locked up, it's sealed up. There's no way out. There's no way, no release here. And John begins to weep and weep and weep. And one of the elders comes and says, John, stop weeping. Somebody has come. Somebody has come. And John turns to see the great warrior king, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, in his majesty and his sword. And he turns to see the might and the power of Israel. And he turns and sees a lamb as it had been slain. So these people are turning, waiting to turn to see the might and the power. The church wants to be there, ruling and reigning with God. But when they really turn to see, what are they going to see? A lamb as it had been slain. But see, the church doesn't want to go down that road. The church wants to keep its foot patting and say, you can't come in, and you can't come in, and you can't come in. The wrath of God is not directed against us. The wrath of God is when God allows us to see what we've really been doing all along. And the truth is, all of our predatory peace was never less violent than this. It's simply that the violence was directed away and against those who we did not see ourselves in. The violence was still there. We just didn't see it for what it was. We don't see ourselves in each other. And the more we don't see ourselves in each other, the easier it is to scapegoat. That's exactly what Isaiah saw with the white horse on the coming with the garments of dyed garments of Bozrah coming from Edom. They thought this was a magnificent rider who had slain all of his enemies. And Christianity thinks that's what it is, that slay all the enemies. I'm going to tell you this, guys. I know I've went way over, and that's okay. But, you know, and one of the things I'm going to tell you this, you remember he says, Solomon in all of his glory wasn't arrayed as one of these, talking about the lilies. And you remember the sign of Jonah? And he said the Queen of Sheba would come and you know, to see the wisdom of Solomon, and one greater than Solomon is here, right? One. So what does he mean by these statements? They come to see how, she come to see how Solomon lived. Solomon, his servants went in, his servants went out, all the glory. But Jesus says one greater than Solomon is here. You don't come to see how Jesus lived. How did he die? That was greater. Do you see? Paul, Jesus, the disciples are telling us to forgive, lay our lives down one for another, lest any root of bitterness spring up in us. The peace that passes understanding. But we try to fight schisms in the body. And really, the life of God is only found in the death. So when I'm trying to talk about the death, and we're going through these things, as we keep going on, I want you to understand this is what I'm talking about. It's not a natural death. It's this death to this whole system. Laying ourselves down. Not scapegoating anybody, not being violent, or not trying to make ourselves feel better because we put other people down. Because we're all guilty. All guilty. So I would say this, and I will close. If the words that we speak do not bring peace and healing, then we need not speak. It's just that simple. And I think we got to make a stand. What stand did Jesus make? I will say again. What stand did Jesus make? He went to the cross. And he's asking us to do the same thing. Because if making a stand would fix the world would have been fixed a long time ago. I'll quit with that.